Welcome to episode 14 of GovX Data Points, where we talk all things government and data. I'm your co-host Eric Reese, joined again this week by my co-host Sharon Paley. In this episode, we talk with Ted Alcorn, Director of Innovation at Everytown for Gun Safety. Everytown is a nonprofit focused on building a movement of Americans who work together to end gun violence and build safer communities. To do this, they provide research, convene stakeholders, and advocate for legislation that will help reduce gun violence across the U.S. As Director of Innovation for Everytown, Ted focuses much of his work on exploring new frontiers for reducing gun violence. This includes looking deeply at data from across the U.S. to find ways for government leaders and community members to join forces to address critical public safety issues. With data and cities as the background, we were very excited to talk with Ted about how we can all take steps to reduce gun violence in our communities.
Thanks for joining us today, Ted. We're really happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So can we just start out generally by speaking about what kind of work Everytown is doing in cities, how you guys are researching innovative solutions that cities are developing for reducing crime and gun violence?
Yeah, Everytown for Gun Safety, the organization where I'm the director of innovation, was founded originally by a group of mayors in cities who were concerned about gun violence and its impact on the quality of life of their residents. So gun violence in cities has kind of been a core concern of our organization since 2006. And while we have expanded as an organization and an attempt to address gun violence and preventable gun injury wherever it occurs in all its forms, gun violence in cities is and should remain a core concern because of the gravity of the issue, particularly in some of our nation's cities, where the stats sort of speak to why it's so important. The cities of the United States as a whole have a gun homicide rate that are about two times the national rate. And so as a result of that, whereas we have about 12,000 Americans murdered with guns every year, one in five of those folks is dying in one of the country's largest cities. So if you want to address the country's extraordinary rates of gun violence, cities really represent a big piece of that.
When you say largest cities, what do you mean?
When I say largest cities, actually, I'm referring to the 25 most populous U.S. cities. So they account for just 10% of the U.S. population, but they account for one in five gun homicides. And I think that also speaks to the fact that if cities and city leaders, who in many cases are leading on this issue, but can demonstrate real impact on gun violence there in just those 25 cities, that would have a really huge measurable impact on the gun homicide rate of the country as a whole.
So Ted, what are some of the strategies that you all are using to make that reduction happen?
Well, cities are as diverse, cities, they share a lot in common in their form and the services they provide, the social problems that they face, but they're also very unique in the demographics and the geography and the scale. And so the solutions that cities are adopting, while they also share commonalities, they have to be informed by the local circumstances. So when we, for this recent report we put together on strategies for reducing gun violence in American cities, when we looked at how these large U.S. cities are experiencing violence, we found there's sort of seven basic strategies that they were adopting, although the combination and the ordering of them varied a lot within cities. So foremost, cities can harness the data that they're producing naturally to better understand the specific factors that drive gun violence there. When I say data, I'm referring to some of the most basic things you would expect cities to do to address a problem, which is to count it and to characterize it. And when it comes to gun violence and gun crime, this can amount to cities conducting a very thorough homicide review, which the models that we have, for example, in Milwaukee, which has a Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission, bring community leaders and police and city leaders together to evaluate the circumstances in which every homicide in the city occurs. And in Milwaukee, about 9 of 10 homicides are committed with guns. And this can create a much more nuanced understanding of what patterns gun homicides are taking there, what locations and circumstances may be contributing. And in Milwaukee, for example, it's informed changes in ordinances around alcohol selling establishments that have been associated with reductions in homicide there. And it's also brought to the community and law enforcement leaders that are participating a sense of efficacy that they are all part of the process of addressing violence there. But the data that cities produce on gun violence, some of it is also a little bit more, it occurs earlier in the process, before a crime occurs. Cities are potentially repositories of a lot of information on where the guns that are being used in crimes come from. They generally, law enforcement are recovering and tracing crime guns, which provides them some unique information into the speed at which guns are traveling from the law-abiding citizens to the street, to the illegal markets, and some of the sources of the firearms that are ending up in criminal hands. And so cities that have taken to analyzing their trace data can make much more informed decisions about what strategies to employ to interrupt the flow of illegal guns to their streets. And that, you know, we've seen implications of that, for example, in a small suburb of Lyons, Illinois, where upon recognizing that a local gun dealer is one of the major sources to the black market street sales in Chicago, they came together with the city law enforcement and the dealer to adopt some responsible sales practices, going beyond just what the law required, to make sure that the dealer was doing everything they could to reduce the chances they'd be selling guns to someone who shouldn't have them. And that's the sort of thing that we'd love to see cities adopting, you know, wherever this proves to be a major social problem, but it always starts with using that data.
So you've put out this Strategies for Reducing Crime in American Cities report. What other kind of work is Everytown doing to amplify these best practices that you're seeing in various cities and get other cities to adopt similar programs?
One of the projects of Everytown for Gun Safety is this coalition of mayors called Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which is a loose coalition of current and former mayors who've committed to addressing gun violence in an evidence-based way, one that's consistent with the Second Amendment, and which who number some 1,000 now. And so part of the work that we've done after putting this report together is to disseminate it to those mayors and to other mayors. We merely are trying to bring together the best practices that cities and law enforcement and researchers have themselves developed over decades of experimentation and analysis. Nevertheless, we think that this is a unique contribution because we do devote the first half of the report to really trying to describe what is known about how gun violence in cities occurs, to essentially create a coherent single explanation of this phenomenon, which is absolutely complex social problem. But because understanding it in a coherent way means that it's much easier to elect solutions to address it that are going to be coherent with how it actually occurs. And then the second half of the report is devoted to case studies of that fall into all these categories of how cities are addressing violence. And so the ways that we're hoping to see this adopted more are, it's not a single set of recommendations that we think every city should adopt. Instead, it's sort of a menu of options that cities have chosen. And when I speak with advocates, grassroots supporters about what they can do in their city, this is a resource that they can take to their local leader, and not necessarily to instruct them how to respond to violence, but to ask them, what measures are you taking, what measures are our city adopting, and how do they fit into how we understand gun violence in our city to be occurring? And I think that that's a powerful way to start dialogue with this premise that gun violence in cities is something that can be understood empirically and then addressed in an evidence-based fashion and evaluated for its success so that we can continue to make progress forward on eliminating this problem.
So I want to follow up on one thing you noted earlier, Ted, and that's you noted Lyons, Illinois, and Chicago, and I'm curious if you're seeing jurisdictions that are near one another start to coordinate efforts and strategies in ways that help to reduce gun violence in both communities.
Yeah, it's important to recognize that whereas cities are this important resolution at which to look at the problem and to think about solutions, because a city has so much skin in the game, so to speak, on reducing violence, can be crushing for a neighborhood's economy, for the business revenue in a very highly affected neighborhood, and the property taxes and real estate values that hinge on that. So it can affect the city. At the same time, gun violence and gun trafficking have these sort of externalities spatially that go beyond the city unit. So I guess what I'm saying there is that whereas cities have a lot to gain by reducing gun violence, it is not always in their sole control to eliminate gun trafficking channels that are coming from the region or even outside the region and yet are fueling violence in their neighborhoods. And that's why we've seen some cities adopt a regional approach. I'm thinking of particularly of folks in the Northeast region, where Boston Mayor Walsh has had a series of annual convenings with law enforcement and mayors from across New England to establish some common responses to gun trafficking, the sort of thing that no city alone there can address, but that by pooling their data or their resources and then coordinating their approaches, they may be able to make a bigger difference. We also see the importance of strong state and federal laws, because cities themselves can adopt practices to, say, require that guns that are lost or stolen be reported to law enforcement, or to ensure that background checks are conducted for all gun sales that take place on city property. They don't have jurisdiction to eliminate those kind of risky transfers outside of their city limits. And in some cases, where states have actually enacted preemption laws that limit city's authority to govern gun safety in their own jurisdiction, it ends up being a matter of the state of state law whether or not those kind of risky gun sales without background checks can occur. And so that's why in the end cities have also called on their state legislators to make these reforms. Golden, Colorado is one that was highlighted in the report that called on the Colorado state legislature to require background checks for all gun sales in 2013. And that added to a groundswell, which ultimately did initiate those changes at the state level. And the state has had a background check requirement for all gun sales since then. And that's been a big success for public safety.
What's been like the biggest success you all have studied in gun usage in a city?
Well, we sort of draw a line in the report between understanding the measures, the outcome measures that we care about most, which are, at their most extreme, just reducing gun homicides that occur in cities. And so certainly we want to see cities making progress there. And of the large cities, again, 80% of them had experienced a significant decline in gun homicides over the last decade. So there's a lot of positive momentum towards the thing we care about most. But at the same time, there's a lot of factors that contribute to a city's overall gun homicide rate. And we definitely want to separate best practices in individual programs from the city level outcomes, only because we don't want to fail to identify opportunities that are evidence-based where programs are working, even if they are making a difference against the current, so to speak, in a city that has other reasons it may be backsliding or experiencing a more elevated rate of gun violence. So that said, the programs that we highlight throughout the report are all presented with the evidence about how impactful they are. Some of those that are most have been applied the most extensively and evaluated the most rigorously include what are known as focused deterrence programs, which are sometimes known by the rubric ceasefire, but which had begun in Boston and has since been used in dozens of cities to bring law enforcement together with the most high-risk residents of high-violence neighborhoods to sort of reset the relationships that they have and the norms that may be prevalent there around the use of violence, so that high-risk groups and who are at high risk, I guess, of committing violence know that there are positive alternatives and opportunities for them that the community wants them to take, but that also if they continue to offend, there are going to be serious consequences for them and other members of their group. And that's been evaluated and is shown to have a significant 20% to 30% reduction in gang or group member initiated acts of violence. And we highlight those a little bit and how it's been applied in New Orleans, a city that has historically been among one of the most violent in the United States, but which also has experienced a huge decline in gun homicides over the last decade. So there's no single approach that I think we would say is sufficient or has proven sufficient in any city, but in cities like New Orleans, which has really taken a everything in the kitchen sink approach by strengthening law, strengthening enforcement, improving the delivery of services and positive alternatives to high-risk folks, curbing those sources of firearms that have been feeding their illegal gun market. There's a possibility to make a big and long-standing difference in safety for the residents of the city as a whole.
So Ted, you mentioned just briefly there some of the other strategies that aren't related to law enforcement. So who are the other folks that are usually involved at the city level beyond police and public safety focused individuals?
Yeah, there's a whole range of changes that ultimately probably need to take place to arrive at cities that are really free of gun violence. And there's absolutely, it's important that cities recognize violence is concentrated within certain geographic areas and certain social networks. That's pretty well established through the research, and that there's a real need to focus on those risky people, risky places. But at the same time, the way that firearms end up in a city and then contribute to violence, even though it may be conducted by a very few small group of people, are much more widespread. And so the behavior of gun dealers who are can be a source of firearms for the illegal market, either through deliberate trafficking or just by not necessarily rising to the standards of conduct that we would hope a responsible retailer to take. So they can play a role. Even the behavior of law-abiding gun owners in a city can make a difference, because the ways that they store their firearms or sell them can contribute significantly to the risk of whether or not they're going to arrive in high-risk hands, so to speak. And I'm thinking particularly of Lafayette, Louisiana, where the local criminal justice coordinating committee was focusing on trying to better understand sources of firearms to the illegal market there, and identified a trend in thefts that were taking place from vehicles, which, as it turns out, constitute one of the top targets for theft of firearms. And in the case to Lafayette, on examining some of these incidents, they discovered that almost half of these thefts were taking place from vehicles that had been left unlocked. And young folks who were looking for an easy score were just trying the doors of vehicles and then removing firearms that had been left in their glove box. And so the city had has been pursuing since then a public information campaign called Love It, Lock It, to educate the broader public on the risk of leaving firearms unsecured in vehicles. And I think that that's an important example of how relying on the data led to identification of a problem and has created the opportunity to try some new solutions. And while the jury's still out on how impactful this public relations campaign is on changing behavior, I think it's a good start to seeing how the broader community needs to be brought in and can engage in reducing the supply of illegal firearms in this way.
So just to pivot for a minute, like directly to a conversation about data, I think that data on gun use is sort of notoriously difficult to get one's hands on and get a holistic sense of what's going on. So how is it that every town approaches that wrinkle?
It's hard to wrestle with a any kind of social policy, public policy issue if you can't see it, can't measure it, can't describe it. And for something that's occurring in such widespread, intermittent ways as gun violence in the city, the numbers are particularly hard to bring together. And because of the nature of the phenomenon itself, but also because the politically contentious debates over gun violence have shown that data can be a very powerful tool. And so folks that are opponents of making progress or making policy on this issue have actually undertaken strategic attempts to make this data more difficult to put together. So for example, you know, and probably most famously, the public health authorities that are sort of the arbiters of data on fatalities, the CDC's National Injury Prevention Control and Prevention Center, since 1996 has really shied away from doing any research on gun violence, because in that year, Congress and the gun lobby's allies in Congress undertook sort of a campaign against the CDC there, where they sought to delegitimize some of the research that they were doing, threatened to withdraw funding from the agency if they pursued further research that those folks at the time said was damaging to the gun rights of the American public. The lead sponsor of that bill, Representative Jay Dickey, has since expressed a lot of regret about pursuing that that campaign against the CDC, and has actually called on the now Congress to eliminate some of the harmful language that they'd introduced then, restricting the CDC's research on gun violence. But as of now, there's still quite a chilling effect that that has had on public health research and data collection for firearm-related injuries and violence. For the purposes of our report, you know, we had to confront this directly because there's no national repository of gun homicide data at the city level that was easy to access. And so we actually had to go to each one of the 25 plus cities that we profiled in the report, and to, through public information requests, assemble a database of gun homicide numbers that had occurred there annually going back a decade, as well as some other types of data, which we include, such as the number of firearms reported lost and stolen in more than a dozen cities, and the number of guns recovered and traced, which are interesting and useful metrics for some of the characteristics of the illegal gun market there, and which are strongly associated with outcomes of violence. So those are critical to have access to and explore. And so, you know, I think cities have been at the forefront of calling on some of the, calling on Congress to eliminate some of the restrictions that they'd imposed over time. They have, and city mayors and law enforcement should continue to do so, because to be fully empowered to address public safety, they need to have the best tools and data at their disposal. And in some cases, that's not possible without some changes in law.
So Ty, I want to finish with just a question for you on what we can do next. So I'm a John Q. public citizen of Washington, D.C., where I live. what can I do to be a part of reducing gun violence in the community, or, you know, getting in touch with my elected officials to make sure it's on their radar?
Well, I'll just speak from the research point of view, which is that there's a pretty broad scientific consensus, and it's been published on, actually, where there's been surveys done of research showing that there is now significant and sufficient evidence assembled to suggest that we have some changes in legislation that would likely reduce gun violence, and that not all states and Congress have adopted. And so there's a strong argument to be made, and certainly one that our organization, Everytown for Gun Safety, is pursuing, that states need to do a better job expanding and strengthening the laws that they have to keep guns out of dangerous hands. And then because of the significant amount of interstate gun trafficking that occurs, such that weak gun laws anywhere end up undermining public safety everywhere, we do also need U.S. Congress to adopt some of the most basic and evidence-based solutions, like requiring a background check for every gun sale, closing some of the loopholes that still allow domestic abusers to buy firearms or retain possession of ones that they already own. And then within cities, you know, there's ample opportunities as well to move beyond just advocating for changes in state and federal law, but to support mayors that are being leaders on this issue, and then calling on mayors who have not been so outspoken to address gun violence. It's not just the dozens or hundreds of people that are killed with guns in any given city each year that are feeling the impact of this. Gun violence, as I said earlier, has a citywide impact by reducing perceptions of safety and the quality of life of people in whole neighborhoods, of depressing property values and business revenue, so the tax base for the city and ultimately the ability to spend on public services is limited. And so every citizen in a city is certainly paying the price of our extraordinary rates of gun violence. And mayors need to know that it should be among their top priorities, but many of them do. And certainly any listener to this can also learn more by visiting our website, everytownresearch.org, where we keep a lot of these reports on our research compiled, and can also sign up for a local chapter of the Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, which is a chapter-based organization that we, is a project of every town and through which citizens can get more involved in local gun violence prevention activities.
That's a great inspirational place to stop, Ted. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks again to Ted for joining us this week. You can learn more about his work and all kinds of data on gun violence at everytown.org. Now it's time for our question of the week, this week honoring the start of classes on campus here at Johns Hopkins. So the question is, in what year was Johns Hopkins University founded? As always, send us your answers via email at govx@jhu.edu or send us a message on Twitter at @gov_ex, and you can suggest a topic for a future episode. Thanks again for joining us this week, and we hope you join us again soon to find out where the data points.